As Granny Liu entered the room, she was confronted by a bevy of unfamiliar young ladies, all resplendent in ornaments of pearl and kingfisher, like a bed of beautiful flowers, none of which she could give a name to. In their midst, a venerable old lady reclined on a couch. A young woman, pretty as a picture and dressed in silk and satin from top to toe, sat behind her, gently pounding her legs. Xi Feng, the only person there she could recognize, was standing to one side of her, evidently in the midst of telling her something amusing. Deducing that the old lady on the couch must be Grandmother Jia, Granny Liu hurried up to her and made an antique curtsy. "Your servant, my lady."
Of crabs.
Oh, so
we're talking
about
value. We're talking about the relativity of value. What is a crab worth?
Indeed. So, well, Zhou Rei's wife, as we mentioned before, I don't think we ever actually learned her name. She's just Zhou Rei Jiada.
No, we never learned her name.
Yeah, Zhou Rei's missus, really. It's like, what did he say? Her indoors. As the English equivalent of Jiada.
I found that online.
She is talking about the crab party, and she's saying they were such big crabs. You could only get, it was probably only two or three per jin, which is a Chinese measurement of weight. Sometimes the word catty is used in English, which is it's the same measure, but it's the Malay word for it, apparently. It's from Malay, anyway.
Oh, interesting.
So a jin is, I don't know, it's maybe about half a kilogram, something like that. But so she's saying that there were maybe 70 or 80 jin in total, basically, is how many they ordered.
And so you've done the calculation.
I tried to do the math. So basically, Granny Liu hears this, and she... Her kind of head spins at that, and she does a kind of quick bit of arithmetic in her head to try and kind of calculate how much that would have cost. So she says, you know, if it's this many, you know, fun of cash for one gin of crab, and there are 80, then if you tally it up, and then you factor in the cost of wine and of the other dishes they would have eaten, she thinks it's about 20 taels of silver for the party.
Oh, wow. Which is about what she received last time she visited, right?
Exactly. So what she was given to see her and her family through the winter. And you'll remember, Xi Feng did give it to her, but she kind of gave it to her maybe with a hint of reluctance, or as if to say, you know, we're a bit short of cash at the moment. I can't give you that much kind of thing.
Although I think it was more than she expected. Right? I think Granny Liu was expecting maybe like a quarter of that.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't sure.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point, yeah. It clearly does see them through the winter very well. She sees that the amount that they would spend in a year, the household is just kind of blown on one party, you know, and not even a big thing like a wedding or some other celebration, but just a bit of fun.
Like a crab party, basically.
crab party.
I think you mentioned, does Granny Liu's, does her math add up completely? Were you able to follow the logic?
It doesn't seem to add up.
Is that the joke?
It doesn't seem to add up.
I imagine she'd be pretty good at these kind of calculations.
I'm not sure.
That seems like that would be a kind of like a rural skill.
If you're selling your
produce on the market, it's really important not to...
Exactly.
To keep the numbers straight.
Yeah, she would be decent at kind of like basic arithmetic and kind of budgeting. So you would think so. But yeah, I couldn't make head or tail of it. She said it's... We can maybe trim this a bit, but she thinks that the the price per jin, so per kind of half kilogram, give or take, is 5 fun, which is essentially like the smallest unit of the money they're using at the time, I think. And then she says 10 jin is 5 qian, so 5 cash, basically.
Okay.
So that qian is like the next measure up above fun.
Okay.
So it like in the... It seems like in the monetary system here, just like you have in modern China, there are technically 3 levels. There's fun, there's qian, and then there's liang, I think, which is a tail of silver. So that's like the biggest thing. Just like nowadays, you have like fun mao kuai or fun jiao yuan. Anyway,
okay, yeah.
I just couldn't really make sense of it. Maybe we can write it out and put it on Twitter and see if anyone can help.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Because yeah, she seemed to be saying it's 5 fun for 1 jin of crab. There are 80 jin of crab, so that means 400 fun worth of crab. And if there's 10 fun to a qian, that would be 40 qian of crab. And that 40 qian of crab somehow turns into like 15 tails. And there's this kind of mismatch between what's in the Chinese and what's in the Hawks. In the Hawks, he says 13. In the Chinese, she says 15. I don't know. Okay. I just couldn't make sense
okay,
of it.
Okay.
But whether it's an accurate figure or not, I think that the observation is basically correct, which is that from her point of view, this is a stupendously extravagant way of spending money.
That's the real takeaway. Even if her calculations are a bit bizarre.
Yeah.
And plus, she's not taking into account. I imagine if you buy more crabs, you get some kind of discount.
That's true, I suppose, if they're shrewd, if they have a shrewd kind of purchasing or procurement department in this household.
I was the like economic historian, like trying to take notes from this.
I don't know. It might be
tearing up the paper in anger.
It might be accurate. Might be
useless
idiots.
Useless.
Anyway, so she, as you say, she realizes that's enough to see her family through a year, or see a peasant family through a year. Having delivered these goods, Granny Liu and Ban Er are preparing to depart because they don't want to get stuck inside the city once the city gates are closed. So presumably, yeah, there's a wall and gates that will shut after sunset or whenever.
Yeah. You don't get stuck in between like Jiare.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You'll freeze your ass off overnight.
Yeah, well, you know, it's starting to get into the cold weather. It would be unwise to be stuck outside. Zhou Rei's wife says, you know, hold on a minute. You should go and see the ladies of the house. You should go and see Lady Wang and Grandmother Jia to kind of pay your respects. So Zhou Rei's wife dashes off, and she's gone a fair while, and you imagine the clock is kind of ticking. Perhaps literally in this case, because I think in chapter 6 there's an observation that there is actually a Western style clock in, I think, Xi Feng's chambers. And then eventually Zhou Rei's wife returns and she says, oh yeah, quick, you know, first of all, Lady Wang says you should stay overnight and she'll give you a room to sleep in. But also Grandmother Jia says, come and present yourself because she wants to speak to an oldie. She's desperate to hear from you, you know, chat to someone her own age and, you know.
So she's like, she's really moving up in the household now.
Oh yeah.
All the way from Xi Feng to Grandmother Jia. That's a pretty big leap.
Yeah.
And so she kind of, they head over there, you know, and she's struck. This is another kind of transitional moment that we highlight in the cold open where she is sort of struck by the exquisite beauty of the surroundings and everyone within them, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly. So do we want to dwell on any of those descriptions? I think just briefly, the description of the kind of women of the young women of the household when Granny Liu kind of emerges into the room. In Chinese it uses this term zhu wei cui rao. So zhu being kind of pearl and cui, as we said, is like jade green or jade itself. And both wei and rao being like kind of surrounded or like you know, enveloped, wrapped around in. So they're described as being almost kind of like smothered in a way in kind of like precious gems. Or at least that's her impression. of these young women, that they're kind of they're covered head to toe in precious stuff, and then it further describes them as Hua Zhi Zhao Jan de. So like Hua Zhi are like flowers and branches, and Zhao Jan is kind of like almost like beckoning, unfurling, something like that. Mm. So again, it's a description of great kind of beauty, I suppose, and elegance. This sort of like comparing women to flowers kind of description.
That might also be that's a set expression. And again, the question is, was it a set expression at the time, or is it a set expression because it appears?
Is it a tall neologism? Could well be. Could well be one of.
I looked it up in the dictionary. It's giving me this chapter.
This is the source. This is the source.
So, And then I usually do a quick check, and I see if it's in the Trentong Shire. And it doesn't appear to be.
Interesting. Interesting.
But yeah, another kind of interesting. Yeah, Bai Ke is saying it's from Honglumeng.
Oh, okay, cool.
Okay, so this is a set expression that was just the author just having a way with words.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, so absolutely.
You can learn your Chengyu, Hua Zhi Zhao Yan. like blossoming plants swaying in the breeze.
Yeah.
But it also, you know, it applies to gorgeously dressed women.
So how does the conversation unfurl or unfold?
Okay, so this conversation is really interesting. And I was thinking a lot about like whether this is a believable conversation. Part of me was sort of was feeling that this sort of strains credulity, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I don't believe necessarily that, like, anyone would ever have this conversation. In the sense that it seems like it's as if the conversation is meant for somebody else. It's meant for, like, the big other or something. Like, it's very much playing with the tropes, you know, and there's a really heavy emphasis on the status difference that's so pronounced that part of me is like, would this ever really happen? But then again, another part of me was thinking, actually, I mean, maybe that's kind of the point here, you know, maybe like it's almost essential in this context to broach the status divide, right? Is that too abstract? Should we jump right into it?
No, I don't think it's too abstract at all. I think it's a good point. I feel like there was a familiarity in it somehow. Or there was something recognizable about the way that she is. I think the way that Grandmother Jia kind of condescends to Granny Liu, not in a... I use condescend in the meaning of literally... She isn't being condescending, I suppose, in the sense of being like unpleasantly patronizing, but simply in the manner of one who is of very noble and high status, speaking in what they consider to be a kind of like pleasant and friendly way with someone of very substantially lower status.
Yeah, you know, she's condescending in the sense that she's like minimizing the social... She's attempting like formally to minimize the social distance between them.
Exactly.
Right? So one way to do that is to speak highly of Granny Liu, right, and to speak of her physical strength, or the fact that her eyes and her teeth are still working well, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Speak of her positive like attributes, her merits as a person. At the same time, that you also kind of emphasize your own sort of shortcomings in order to make yourself seem not so high and mighty and distant, right? And so Grandmother Jia makes a big point of comparing, Granny Liu's perfect, perfect teeth with her own, or her Grandmother Jia talking about her own poor hearing and poor memory, right? Kind of to like the point is. Each of them is trying to show, you know, actually, you know, my lot isn't so bad. Or in the case of Grandmother Jia, my lot isn't necessarily, you know, it's not
so good. Yeah.
ideal leisure every single day. Yeah. It's a way of kind of justifying profound, you know, difference in power and status.
Yeah, it has a little bit of the feeling of when Bao Yu meets his friend Qian Zhong for the first time. And he has this profound sense of how much better it would be to be like Qian Zhong and be not so kind of noble and airy, but you know, much more kind of part of
honest, straightforward.
Yeah.
And just like less fake, you know, less immersed in fakery.
Precisely.
And in keeping up appearances.
The way that they address each other, I think, is interesting because that's right at the start. Granny Liu, Liu comes forward and she addresses her as Lao Shou Xing. So Lao being literally old. And I mean, that literally is true here, but it's also, I think, meant in a sort of respectful sense. Shou being, I mean, kind of like long life, something like that here. And Xing being a star. So like old, long life star. But it's a set term of kind of respect for, I guess, a kind of older, an older relative or one senior somehow. Even though actually I think here Grandmother Jia is younger than Granny Liu. And Grandmother Jia in turn calls Granny Liu Lao Qin Jia. So old again in the respectful sense, and then Qin Jia is like, it's one's family member, but it's like almost like kinsman or like kinswoman or like clanswoman, something like that, you know?
Yeah. My old relation.
Yes. Yes. It's almost like you might call someone cousin in English, even if you weren't literally first cousins. You know, it's a sort of like familial type expression.
Yeah.
Because as we mentioned, the familial link, to the extent it exists between them, is extremely distant.
Yeah. We talked about that a while ago, right?
Yeah.
It's almost entirely based on...
It's basically exceedingly remote, we'll put it that way. You know, when someone says like, oh, I'm like very distantly related to like the queen or whatever, it's that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. So how does that conversation go? Should we talk through that?
Okay, so they talk about, you know, age. We learn that Granny Liu is 75 this year.
Yeah.
Grandmother Jia's exact age is not given, but she's indicated that she is somewhat younger, in fact.
Yes.
And they talk about, you know, their health. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a generic conversation in that, you know, like, how's your health?
Yeah.
That's very common.
She says, are your eyes and teeth good? You know. I thought it was rather like inspecting a horse somehow.
Well, I mean, well, you know, maybe because she is eating all this, like, rich, she's not, because she isn't having delicacies, maybe her teeth are better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
She's not eating precious cakes and, you know, an expensive alcohol and whatever else.
Yeah. Well, this the suggestion, something I've read is that really poor dental like hygiene, you know, tooth decay, really only became quite kind of acute for humans with the discovery of sugarcane. Well, at least for kind of people outside of the Americas, I suppose. Because prior to that, even though sugar was part of the diet in some ways, it wasn't kind of readily available in pure form. And it's that more than anything that kind of really led to serious deterioration in people's teeth. And
also a deterioration in human relations. Because
most
of that sugar, that was the worst kind of agricultural labor. It's almost entirely slave-based.
Yeah.
And so you have like, yeah, you're just degrading like human species being for like the cheapest like kind of pleasure imaginable. It's a weird kind of element of when people talk about like making your history more like materialistic, having a more material view of history, sometimes it takes you down these weird like rabbit holes. It's really strange to think that our shared humanity is contained in, but also like fractured in like sweet treats.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But no, it's a really, really good point. But that would have been incredibly current at this time.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
So the sugar that I think presumably would have made its way into the diet of the Jah family would have been, grown in Caribbean plantations or possibly in some kind of Asian equivalent. So she says, her teeth are very good, apart from one loose molar, I think it is. It's referred to as a caoya in Chinese, which I think is, kind of like wisdom tooth or molar or something like that. It's gone a bit loose, but the others are all good. And, that is believable. There are skeletons found of, people who lived before the advent of readily accessible sugar, and their teeth are, I wouldn't say they're good. that some of them may have broken, and in some cases they've kind of grown and like fused together.
Right.
They're rather kind of weathered, but they're all there. They're not all kind of rotten and fallen out.
Right.
And as you mentioned, Grandmother Jah kind of like she sort of like denigrates or brings herself down as part of that condescension that we talked about. She says that, Granny Liu is kind of hale and hearty. She's ying lang by comparison to herself. she says the things she describes herself as bu zhong yong, so kind of useless, having no kind of use. She says that she's yan hua, so like her eyes are blurry. Her vision is kind of blurry, foggy, and her ears are kind of going deaf, and her memory is not what it used to be. She's afraid of kind of people mocking her or laughing at her, and she just spends her time eating a thing or two, having a nap, kind of killing time, and making jokes with the grandchildren.
Right.
That's about all she does.
Although they have some really like interesting remarks, where it's it's naturalized to such their social difference is naturalized to such a degree that it's kind of startling from our perspective, where Granny Leo's essentially saying, I was born like a farmer or a rustic or what have you, and this is like what I was like bent to be. It's like it's in my blood, kind of. So does. Is more or less the tenor of her rhetoric, right? It's very much invoking like an ancient order. This is the way it's always been. It's very conscious in a way that I thought was kind of remarkable.
Yeah, she uses, there's this neat little parallel. She says, "Woman, sheng lai shi shou ku de." So we were, as you said, born. Sheng lai is like born to. You're kind of born to it, like. Shouku is to like to suffer hardship, really.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of a line from the Mencius, from the Mengzi, one section of the Mengzi, the Tang Wengong section, where there's basically they create kind of a taxonomy of people. Basically, he says there's two kinds of people: those who labor with their minds, and those who labor with like physical exertion, right?
And
in this text it's very much like the people who use their minds are meant to rule over the people who use their bodies, and so you see like the same rhetoric being recapitulated in their dialogue.
It's very clearly internalized, that, isn't it?
So I had like flashbacks of Confucian text.
I think that's a really good comparison to draw. I think it's very, very kind of apt. Whereas she says that they are shouku, so like that suffer hardship, she compares Granny Jah saying, Grandmother Jah saying that she is sheng lai shi xiang fu de, so she is to like enjoy good fortune. She, it's her lot in life basically to enjoy good fortune.
Yeah, again, it's her, like her duty is to enjoy. Yeah. Just as like it was the imperial kind of injunction that they have to move into the garden, they have to enjoy the garden, right?
I specifically
that's their lot in life is to be, which again, it's a little weird, but honestly, is our society any different, right? We have like Some people are like, if you're like a rock star, it's like it's that's your lot in life is to rock. You know, you have to do it. It's your sacred mission, right? And people, no matter what the occupation is, people will be like, this is my, I was meant to be a proctologist. I was meant to, whatever it is, you know, people like really start to identify with this stuff.
Well, I mean, it does, it feels rather miserable if you're doing something that you feel like isn't really your calling. So a lot of the time, absolutely, people kind of retcon.
Yeah, it's virtue, the virtue ethics of making necessities into virtues, right?
Just one thing this reminded me of. So the comparatively like poorer health of Grandmother Jia just kind of reminds me that nobody in the Jia household really seems to do any cardio. like, you never really see any of them exercising.
Right.
I just think, like, the most they do is occasionally go for walks.
Yeah, well, if you over-identify with uselessness, then all of a sudden you can't even use your own body. That's the famous anecdote from Thorsten Veblen's Theory of the Leisure Class. There's this one king who, like, his, like, servant fell asleep, and he was so, according to the story, he was so, like, opposed to exerting any effort whatsoever that he just sat there and let himself be roasted before the fire.
Oh, my gosh.
this, like, this famous, like, you know, like, you can't, like, I'm not going to use my... Am I supposed to stand on my feet?
Am I supposed like to save chump? Myself from death?
No, you know, I go straight from the bed to the caravan or to the rickshaw or whatever, and you can tell I'm large and in charge because my feet no longer function.
There is a kind of slightly funny story about that actually, which I remember reading from. I think it's from Julia Lovell's History of the Opium War, where. She talks about this kind of conflict between Chinese and sort of Western cultures in the realm of exercise and sports. And one of the things that the Chinese found very perplexing about the European practice of playing tennis was this like doing exercise, getting yourself all kind of hot and sweaty. And it kind of, you know, like shakes the organs around somehow. And yeah, one Chinese observer asked this kind of British person why they couldn't just pay someone else to play tennis for them. like, and I think that just sort of perfectly, just encapsulates this.
Well, isn't that Donald Trump's idea of like he doesn't exercise because actually it's bad to you, it's bad to expend the energy.
Oh, really?
It's the same kind of idea. Like, no, I'm actually in the best shape. I don't exercise, therefore I'm going to live longer. Because if you think about it, if you don't use it, it won't.
Yeah, it won't get used up.
It won't get used up. Yeah.
Sorry, bit of a digression there.
The point being, these are common mental afflictions.
Mm-hmm. And so during their conversation, you know, Grandmother Jia, she sort of poo-poos the idea that she's fortunate. She says she's just an old piece of rubbish, basically. She's an old piece of garbage. And she says she's heard that Granny Liu has brought some kind of country veg for them and that it's, you know, so much better than the rubbish they sell around here. And so she's very grateful for that. And Grandmother Jia says, you must come and visit the garden because there are things growing in the garden as well. You know, we grow some food of our own here too. And I think that this is sort of like the sort of like patronizing wealthy person's idea of it's the Marie Antoinette little like farm thing kind of coming through, right?
Yeah, check out my cucumbers.
Oh, we have a farm too. Kind of totally out of touch rich people. There is one slightly funny comment where Wang Xifeng says that, Granny Liu should stay because even though they don't have as much space here as she might be used to out on the farm, they'll still find a room for her. And I thought that was a very funny comment because I thought she surely can't seriously believe that, that peasants are all living in great kind of, you know, in some kind of abundance of space out there in the countryside.
I mean, I guess if you take the night sky as your abode, then maybe you could argue that, but
yeah, there are lots of big open spaces, no doubt, but I think the houses themselves may be quite cramped.
And so I guess it's here that we, how about we transition to, this is kind of Granny Liu storytelling time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's some great stuff here.
Having been invited to stay the night, she's packed off to have a bath and change clothes. that first of all has to happen, you know.
Yes, is she the first guest to the Jack household who's been bathed? Or
it's almost like she's been de-loused or something.
Again, that kind of I wasn't sure how to read that. I think it's meant to be kind of funny, and a bit of a critique. Mm-hmm. And they also give her clothes as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is pretty amazing if you think about it. But I mean, again, it isn't that amazing. It's, you know, she's been on a long trip. That's why it's so hard to interpret some of these things, because it's like, mm-hmm. am I overreading this? Because it really does seem like they're giving her like more civilized clothes so that she can like blend in better.
Yeah, so that she can play the role of jester.
A little bit, yeah.
So what are her stories? What does she talk about?
Okay. Well, you know, the first story that really catches everyone's attention, especially Bao Yu, is, it doesn't have a title. Let's give it a title. The wood pile maiden. How about that? Something like that. The ghost maiden who pilfered wood. I don't know. How about that?
The firewood stealing young.
Well, should I read the hawks or should I give a synopsis?
Why not read the hawks?
Basically, there's a winter morning, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been an issue lately of someone, she hears somebody stirring, you know, by the wood pile. Mm. And she was thinking, well, somebody's stealing my firewood. And so Granny Liu, she says she went out to find her, but she found a young lady, maybe 17 or 18 years of age, beautiful, wearing a nice red dress and like a fancy, like a satin skirt. Mm-hmm.
And very kind of sleek, like sleek black hair.
Kind of like really out of place for this rustic scene. Mm. And you can imagine, so Bao Yu is listening, and this is his favorite kind of story because it involves maidens, right? And so he's like, you know, listening with bated breath to learn more about this mysterious beauty.
Who's this beautiful lady,
Beside the woodpile. Kind of a nice scene. Mm-hmm. But at this point, actually, something's happening in the Jia compound.
Yeah.
And there's actually a fire has broken out. And of course, they're talking about the woodpile. So everyone's first reaction is that, it's a kind of a superstitious where they think talking about wood has provoked the fire somehow.
Yeah, although of it, absolutely. Although obviously it couldn't have because...
Speak of the devil kind of thing, right?
Exactly that, right. But it couldn't have in practice. I mean, even if we don't just dismiss it as superstition outright, it couldn't have happened because the fire seems to have already begun before she started the story.
Okay. But then again, maybe the supernatural beings, maybe they can see into the future.
Yes, that's a good point. She uses this interesting expression, Zhou Shui, to mean a fire. So that's literally like the water is gone. The water has taken a walk kind of thing.
Okay.
Which, is highly euphemistic, but maybe comes from that same sort of superstitious school of thought of not referring to the thing by its name, using some kind of indirect way of referring to it so that you know what you mean, so that everyone knows what you mean, but you aren't actually saying the thing out and thereby kind of, you know, attracting the...
Yeah, like the...
Bringing the disaster down on your head.
If you speak it, it only becomes stronger. Mm. And so the problem is, you know, everyone insists now that Granny Liu tells a different story, right? Mm. Everyone except Bao Yu, and he's not going to let it down, actually.
Yeah.
And so like he kind of like he presses her a little bit.
Yeah. He sort of parks it for now until she tells this other story, and then, you know, as soon as mm-hmm. as soon as he gets a chance, he's gonna get more information, gonna try and like pry more information out of her, right?
And actually, and everyone kind of senses that he's anxious about this, and this opens up the opportunity for Dayu to land maybe her one of her greatest Baoyu burns. Yeah, I really want to start collecting all the best Dayu vis-a-vis Baoyu burns, mm-hmm. right? Maybe make like a top 10 list when all is said and done.
You can do a listicle.
But I really enjoyed this one. I literally laughed out loud when I came upon it in the text.
Yep.
And so Baoyu's actually talking about something else. He's talking about the circumstances for Xiangyun's return, mm-hmm. right? She's going to come back soon. And they're trying to decide upon the date, maybe even the appropriate moment in the season.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. I think she was saying Grandmother Jia loves it when it's raining or snowing.
Oh, okay, okay.
Think that what it was saying... It was saying, you're right, they should have a return party since Xiangyun hosted. But Baoyu says Grandmother Jia wants to have one to pay her back anyway, so why don't we just tack it onto that? And then Tan Chun says, oh, we shouldn't wait too long because it will get really cold in winter and Grandmother Jia doesn't like to get cold. But Baoyu's like, oh, but she loves watching snow and frost and things, so, you know.
They can have a snow viewing party.
Yeah.
And then Dayu chimes in. Perfect timing. It would be more romantic still, said Dayu dryly, if instead of chanting poems, we had a big bundle of firewood and took it in turns to tiptoe through the snow and pull out sticks from it. Yes. And it was good because they'd kind of stopped talking about the firewood for a while, yes. the firewood maiden, and she kind of brings it back right when you're on the verge of forgetting it.
Yeah. And Dayu is struck dumb by this.
Yes, yeah, he can't handle it.
I do just want to talk about the other story that they're on. You mentioned there had been a bit of a break since they spoke about the firewood, obviously with the fire breaking out and then being put out. Granny Liu diplomatically decides to talk about something else. And she tells the story of how... I mean, it's a bit like the story of... I think she's called Elizabeth in the New Testament. Is the cousin of Mary, mother of Jesus. She's the mother of John the Baptist, and she had become a very old woman, far older than women would normally, than the age that women normally stop being able to conceive children. But because of her piety, God blesses her with a child, and that child becomes John the Baptist, I think. And likewise, in this story, there's an old woman who she had a son, and that son had a son of his own. But this grandson mm-hmm. sadly died at a young age. And because of her piety, one of the gods intervened to change her fate and allowed her to have another grandson so that her mm-hmm. line might continue.
And you can kind of imagine here that this is an example of Liu Laolao like having a kind of a relatively developed or refined sense of like social graces,
yeah.
and also as a storyteller of considering your audience, because this story seems like perfectly suited to move, you know, the women of the Jia compound, right?
Yeah.
Who themselves are like obviously going to be anxious about having an heir and continuing.
Well, yeah, you know. I think what's particularly shrewd about it is it mirrors the story of Baoyu and his older brother Jia Zhu, you know, who he was the heir. He was Grandmother Jia's grandson, and then he died, probably what in his late teens or early 20s, I think, sometime around that age, and. There was quite a big gap in age, quite a big difference in age between Jia Zhu and Jia Baoyu. You know, he was born a lot of time afterwards, when I think mm-hmm. Lady Wang was already comparatively older.
Mm. Okay.
So I think you mentioned that this is tailored to the audience. I think very shrewdly so. In fact, she's
she
probably knows that this is the case, and so she's kind of accidentally on purpose telling the story that will make all of them go, ah, yes, this is a... In much the same way, we have been blessed because of our own inherent piety or virtue in some other way.
And it's much better than, you know, the firewood maiden story that really only interested Bao Yu.
He was gripped by that, wasn't
and
he?
And so she kind of adjusted her her strategy to good effect.
Yeah, yeah, she's changed. She's changed to suit circumstances, to suit the taste of the audience. Okay, so Bao Yu, as we said, has just been kind of stung by this insult, this mockery from Dai Yu. What does he do now?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, his fixation has not dissolved.
Yeah, not diminished in the slightest.
Not in the slightest. And so he finally kind of... pulls Granny Liu to the side and he like starts interrogating her more or less. And it's very clear, and the author is explicit about, she's just making stuff up at this point. If she hadn't been from the beginning, right? And she gives a kind of like these like bogus directions like a completely fabricated description of the shrine, right? Yeah. The shrine that was in disrepair and as a result, you know, causing this like spirit to roam the land, disquieted and searching for firewood.
She says, there was this couple who had this daughter, and yeah, she died young, and so they made this. This shrine to her memory, where the parents and others gave offerings, but as we learned, they died some years past, and so the whole thing is kind of fallen into disrepair. She's clearly doing quite a good job of stringing him along. She says, actually, the villagers are thinking of destroying the temple with sticks, to get rid of the spirit. And Bao Yu says, oh no, you mustn't do that. That's a terrible crime to destroy a temple. And she goes, oh, right, okay. Good thing you told me. I'll have to go back and tell them when I return tomorrow.
Oh man, Bao Yu's going to be so easy to swindle when he's older. I mean, almost without any prompting, he's like, oh, doesn't matter, I'll fund the restoration.
Yeah. Yeah. He says, we in this family, you know, my mum and grandmother especially, really, we go in for philanthropy in a big way. And especially like fixing up old temples that have fallen into disrepair. And I just think that's so funny because it's like perfect illustration of how so much philanthropy is completely useless. Like in material terms, that is a completely useless thing to do, repair a temple, like much less useful than like just like direct distribution of assets, you know, like provision of food and housing and education and like other forms of like training or like other material assistance.
It's like when you have the library that was like received money from the Carnegies or the Mellons,
yeah,
and like it has this like impressive facade, but like within inside there's like no books.
Yeah. yeah it reminded me a lot of like modern philanthropy. I'm like, oh yeah, this sounds familiar.
Although, you know, this is maybe slightly less useless than remember earlier they it was the same lady who basically cursed Bao Yu. Also managed to get them to fund like a continuously burning candle or something.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
I would say that's even more useless.
That certainly seems that way. Yeah,
right. It's like literally just burning.
Yeah,
not to burning be away funds.
Yeah, not to be too aggressive about it. But yeah, that does seem like a particularly useless gesture.
Because you know, if you restore a temple, maybe people could pray there or gather or have like meetings.
And I suppose some people will be paid in the employment of, you know, reconstructing it.
It's all good because of it has a Keynesian effect.
Indeed,
stimulating the
stimulus,
the local economy. Yeah.
Balyut, having probably squeezed everything he can out of Granny Liao in terms of information, he is up much of the night planning, and then in the morning he calls up his manservant, Tea Leaf, and sends him off to find this temple.
Yeah. So this is the great outward flow that I was trying to emphasize earlier. This is his, like, he's going out into the world in search of, you know, he's not searching for interest. He's searching for things of interest. That's kind of a nice way to frame it. And he does not find it. He finds some other, like, dilapidated structure that's completely unrelated, dedicated to a plague god.
A plague
god. So, like, a male beast with a blue face and red hair.
Yeah, it's quite kind of well told, I think. You know, the way the story is told here, you know, Balyut is pacing nervously in the manner I imagine of the kind of, like, the 1950s husband in the hospital corridor while his wife is having a baby in the room. You know, just pacing outside the room where the wife is having the baby. you know, kind of running hands through the hair, smoking the cigarette. and yeah, anyway, Tea Leaf returns around about sunset, so he's been out all day. And he looks rather pleased with himself. And he says, well, it wasn't exactly where I followed the directions you gave me, but it wasn't exactly there, and I had to do a lot of looking around. But eventually I did find this very tumble-down shrine on an embankment, as you mentioned. And when I went in, you know, the statue was so lifelike and terrifying, I ran right back out. And Balyut said, well, you know, of course, it's a girl who comes to life, no wonder. Tea Leaf says, no, there was no girl. There was, this plague god with blue face and red hair. Interestingly, the blue word here is qing. We mentioned this before.
Our favorite.
It can be lots of different colors.
Could be green.
Most commonly, it's blue or green, or like a kind of blue green.
Black.
But it can also describe black. Exactly. Yeah, like bruises. Bruises can be described as qing when they're like blackish, but it can be kind of like blacky, bluey green, or like a very, very dark blue green. But I was kind of interested in this, so I looked it up. And in one dictionary, it had all of these different quotes about what color qing is. I had one of them said, qing, dongfang se ye. So qing is the color of the east. Or someone had just simply said, mu se ye. So it's the color of wood. Already maybe here trees, you know. So I'm imagining kind of like pine forest in the mist. That's the color that qing is, like a kind of dark, deep green.
Okay.
One of them said, gan se. Liver colored. I really don't know. It's like this. It's like very. Is it when it's used to describe hair? It's black. Qing means black. But the rest of the time, yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like a dark, bluish green, I suppose. Although, it's perhaps one of the most fluid descriptions of color or color terms in Chinese. It reminded me of do you know this thing of in the Iliad, Homer describing the sea as wine colored or wine dark, I think he said.
Yes, I was just thinking that. Yeah, it's basically, yeah, it's a color of the sea, therefore the color of wine. End of story. I will have to take questions. Mic drop.
Yeah. Elaborate on that.
It is the color
elaborate
of the
on
sea,
that. No.
Which is also the color of wine. Everyone knows. Absolutely. It is a good example of, you know, like not trying to like narrow down these terms in terms of like, oh, I've discovered the true frequency of qing.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it's not how it works. It's an association. It's like a network.
Yeah.
A node in a shifting network.
I think that's probably where the chapter wraps up, isn't it?
That's basically it, right? That was chapter 39. We're going to do chapter 40 next time. Lady Jia holds two feasts in one day in the Prospect Garden. And Faithful makes four calls on three dominoes in the Painted Chamber. That sounds pretty good.
Yes.
We're going to find out what happens there.
One of the games is quite good fun.
Okay, great. So this has been another Rereading the Stone. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Feel free to... We love to hear from you. Ask us questions. We love feedback,
any
commentary, critique.
Economic historians?
Yeah.
Any
complaints
economic historians
are
out there,
fine
please.
As well, if they're relatively
please
polite.
Well received.
And so we are on Twitter at Rereading Stone. So it's pretty easy to get in touch. But thanks for listening. And until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.